Blog Talk Radio.
Good morning, everyone.
Blog Talk Radio.
Good morning, everyone. This is Steve from AGLCA's Homeport. As usual, Janice and Beth and Roger are all supposed to be here, but the only one that showed up so far is Beth. So I don't know where the other two people are, but we'll figure it out as we go along. Our co-host today is Bob Kunith, who is an editor for Waterway Guides. And Bob is going to be talking about the Rideau Canal and the Trent Severn Canal's waterway. At any point, as we're talking, if you want to call in to ask Bob a question, you can call toll-free at 877-497-1815. Bob, thanks for co-hosting today. You know, I think we should start with an overview of the canals and you know, why don't you just start?
Sure. Well, good morning, and hello to everybody, wherever you are. I hope that you're somewhere up near Canada or should be in there by now. But anyway, the two canals we're going to be talking about today are the Rideau and the Trent Severn waterways. And most loopers bypass the Rideau. Almost everybody has to take the Trent Severn. There's no other way to get from Lake Ontario to Georgian Bay unless you go the Lake Erie route. But just a little bit of the Rideau Canal. After the War of 1812, the Brits were pretty well worried about these upstarts to the south who were causing all this trouble. So their main route from Kingston, which was the capital of Canada at the time, up to Montreal, was the St. Lawrence Waterway, their seaway. And they said, well, it wouldn't be too hard for the Americans to take control of that, so they decided to build an alternate route from Kingston up to Ottawa and then down the Ottawa River to Montreal. So they allocated about, I believe it was somewhere between $2 and $3 million, and they got Colonel John By, who was a British engineer, to head the effort. And they built it in, I think it was only 3 years, from basically 1826 to 1829. It's 145 miles from Kingston to Ottawa. There's 45 locks, and he managed to do that in 3 years. As a side note, if I'm not mistaken, he went over budget and was court-martialed. So, I wish they would do that in the States, but we don't do that. Anyway, there's a lower part of the Rideau Canal, which was called the River Styx, and River Styx, as in the mythical thing. It was pretty swampy, and believe it or not, they lost 500 workers to malaria, of all things.
In Canada.
Right. It was pretty difficult digging this thing out. Now, the other thing is, you wonder why there's so many locks, 45 locks and only 125 miles. They had quite a few flights that would be more than one lock together. Right away, the first lock you come to has three locks on a flight. And the reason for that is these guys had no computers, no slide rules, nothing. They said, how high can you make a lock without worrying about the dirt and the water pressure caving the walls in? And they didn't know, so they said, well, let's go with 10 feet. It's a very scientific evaluation. It apparently worked because those lock walls are still there. They're the same blocks that were cut out by hand by all the thousands of workers that spent their lives on this thing. And they're still in place. The mechanics are, virtually all of them, are still the original cast iron wheels and door frames and, tracks and so on,
yeah.
And the gates. They're all original cast iron, and the wood, of course, they've had to replace on all of the doors and so on over time, but the walls are still secure. And they do have a company that manufactures authentic replacements for the cast iron parts. So they designate this as a historic site way back when. So anyway, that one was done in 3 years. The other one, the Trent Severn, it was, I'll get into that one later. So
okay.
Anyway, that's the basic history of the Rideau Canal. You can find a whole lot more about that as you're traveling north at Smith's Falls. There's a terrific museum that traces the whole history.
Okay. Can we talk about the beginning and end locations for both canals?
Yeah, sure. Yeah, again, the beginning is a very short distance from Kingston. You just start sailing up the thing and you come to it. The Ottawa is the northern end, and that's a great destination. July 1st is Canada Day. If you can get there then, you're going to be terrific.
That's today, isn't it?
Is it today, July 1st? If you're not there, you're late. It hadn't occurred to me, but that is the truth. Boat restrictions, by the way, you need to have 5 foot or less draft. And I think 65 feet, I believe, is your restriction on the length. And as far as the height on both canals, it's 22 feet. So it's a little more generous than the Erie Canal, not much, but a little bit more. So if you got through the Erie, you can go through the Canadian canals. A little bit about how this thing works. So every one of the canals has an approach wall with bollards that you can tie up to. The half of that is typically a blue line painted blue on the curb. The other is either not painted or yellow or something like that. And the reason for that is there is no VHF procedure. There's no telephone procedure. If you want to go through a lock, you pull up to that blue line tie-up, and that'll tell the lockmaster that you want to pass through. If instead you want to spend the night, all you got to do is tie up to the wall that's not painted. And if it's late in the day and there's no more lockings the room is needed, you may tie up with permission on the blue line, but you got to get out of there with the first lockage in the morning. If this sounds a little confusing, when you hit the first lock at either the Ottawa or Kingston End, there will be a gentleman from the Park Service who greets you, spends a good 20 minutes describing everything, how to do it, and, of course, he takes your fee. And if you're doing a round trip on the Rideau, the best way to do that is a season pass. It's about $9 per foot. And if you can also do a one-way pass, which I believe is $6 a foot, through the entire canal system, as long as you have never backtracked. There's also day and week passes, but they're probably not worth mentioning. You're going to be up there too long. The second thing you want to look into is a mooring pass, which allows you to tie up overnight at any of them, including all the state parks. So for one fee, which is $9 or $10 a foot, you can spend the entire season tying up at any Parks Canada dock, whether it be a lock or in one of the state parks or whatever, anywhere. I mean, that's a huge bargain. I mean, if you like traveling instead of staying in a home marina, you'll spend, for my boat, let's say, $350 for the entire season, to dock anywhere you want within the system. Now, the downside of that is they all have bathrooms and water, but they don't. Only maybe one out of six or seven have hydro, what they call, or electricity. And then if you do need electricity, it's $10 a day. So it's not uncommon to see local boats traveling four or five in a small fleet, let's say, 30-foot boats or so. And one of them brought along a Honda generator with it, which they put under a picnic table and string extensions to everybody. So it's kind of funny to watch that. There's another thing that's kind of interesting is these canals are destinations within themselves. You will find as you go into, particularly the Rideau, I think, even more than the Trent Severn, you'll stop and talk to a guy who's got a tent set up or a picnic canopy or something, and his boat is there, and he's obviously settled in for a day or two. And you talk to him about it. Oh, yeah, I do this on vacation every week. I come to this canal, this lock, for a day or so, fish a little bit, camp. So, well, what are you going to do tomorrow? Well, I'll probably go up to the next lock. there's some gorgeous, there's some park like that. Pick a lock and stay. You can only stay a couple of days at each one, but heck, there's 45 to choose from. So not a big deal.
Can you talk some about the notable locations on the Rideau?
Yeah, sure. The your first night, well, you're going to start going through this River Styx that I mentioned, and then right through this swamp, which I believe they call Strawberry Lake or Cranberry Lake or something. It can be an issue. There's all kinds of floating green stuff on it that might keep a good speed going through there. I don't mean cruising or anything, but, you know, don't hesitate. Because I did see Grand Banks that got bound up in the stuff when he got... Yeah, I mean, the boats themselves keep the channel clear, but don't wander. That green stuff, it's like the stuff that's down in on the Tennessee River, and I forget which lake it is that has all that floating, what do they call it? So you want to be cautious of that.
Is it something that wraps around props?
It can slow you down and bind up your props, so don't be afraid to go through at a decent speed. The first night, I would recommend staying in a little bay. Look on your chart. It's about a day's travel from Kingston, which is not a big distance, maybe, you know, 25, 50 miles. Morton Bay, it's on the starboard side going north. And when you find it up from your charts, by the way, in that area, you start seeing these towering rocks and these gorgeous palm pine trees and so on. You really know that you're approaching North Canada. You'll see the little channel opening on the side. Morton Bay is a fjord with towering cliffs around all sides. And you'll be tempted to put some Vaseline on your hull as you go through the entrance into that thing because it is tight. It's well marked, but you're going to see the rocks within feet of both sides of your hull as you go through there. But once you get in, it's spectacular. It's one of the most beautiful spots we've found on the entire loop. The next day up from there, there's Jones Falls. That's a flight of three locks. And you'll take a short walk from the lock to see this Jones Fall Dam, which is, by today's measures, not very spectacular. It's 50 feet or so. But it was known as the eighth wonder of the world in 1829 when they built the thing.
Mm-hmm.
And then you go on from there, and every town has its, or every area, a lot of them, of course, you're out in the middle of nowhere, but many of them, there's plenty of hotels and restaurants and activities. One of them, a town that's a must-stop, in my opinion, is called Merrickville, and there's a little hotel right on the corner very near the canal that was spectacular. Somebody clued me in that it was a 4-star restaurant, and I had to agree. And yet it wasn't expensive. You know, it was certainly a worthwhile stop. And there's a museum there, too, which is worthwhile. Moving forward, Smith Falls is another great town, and that's where the museum is that outlines the history of doing. Smith Falls itself is a pretty good-sized town with some decent restaurants. There's electricity there, by the way. And what is not there, unfortunately, is the Hershey Chocolate Factory used to be there, but it's unfortunately been closed. And then when you get up into Ottawa, rather, you get to tie up on the wall of the Ottawa River downtown, right across the street from Parliament. And on the other side of the street is one of the Fairmont Hotels. I forget the name of this one, but it's you know, one of the several that resembles the Chateau de Frontenac up in Quebec. Mm-hmm. So that is spectacular. The museums, the shops, the farmers market, and all of that is just unbelievably nice. Every day they do the changing of the guard. And of course, today is Canada Day, so they're all going crazy, and tonight they'll have the fireworks. But, you know, it's funny, walking around the square, I asked five different Canadians, tell me what Canada Day is all about. What are you celebrating? And nobody knew. I mean, I got a couple of different answers. I don't know if any of them are right or not, because I don't know the history, but it's something to do with the separation from England, but nobody could really nail it down. And if you tour Parliament up there during the day, during the business days, you get to sit in the gallery and listen to them debate. And we couldn't believe the fortune. We're sitting there in the gallery, and the topic that came up they were debating was whether or not to raise the fees on the canal system. I mean, how do I? I wanted to raise my hand and say, "Hey, can I help you?" You know?
Can I give you some advice on that?
So then, of course, in Ottawa is the flight of eight locks that goes down to the Ottawa River. Now it takes about two and a half hours in each direction. But it's something you got to do. I mean, hundreds of people line the shores. It's the major tourist attraction in Ottawa. Everybody's watching, hoping that somebody's going to screw up, right? So, but it is kind of neat to be the attraction. You know, you wave to the folks and all that stuff. They should go through these locks. You get down to Ottawa, and there's a terrific museum on the other side of the river. And there's a marina right there, the Hull Marina, that you can stay at overnight and then reverse your path in the morning if you don't decide to go down to Montreal instead. Of course, the other way to do this is to go down to St. Lawrence, to Montreal, work your way upstream on the Ottawa, and then traverse the Rideau Canal back to Kingston on your way to Trent-Severn.
Okay.
So.
This is about the point I always say to the listeners, if you want to ask Bob any questions, give us a call at 877-497-1815. You want to talk about the Trent-Severn a little bit now?
Sure. Yeah, but one thing I don't think I mentioned about both locks is that the mechanics of the lock itself, by the way, they have these vinyl-coated steel cables that are fastened to the top of the lock wall, and they're also fastened to the bottom of the lock. So what you typically do is you can get away with as little as one breast line just wrapped around the cable. Do not tie it. Just wrap it around behind the cable and back to the boat. And then the two of you station yourselves at both ends of the boat with boat hooks to keep the bow and the stern off the wall. The walls are in fairly good condition up there, by the way. They're not like the Erie Canal, which has a lot of divots in them. These are a lot better shape. But still, you want to have a mess of fenders. So anyway, on to the Trent. Trent was built, started in 1833, I believe it was. Again, this one was originally conceived as a way to get commercial freight back and forth to Georgian Bay from Ontario. The problem was that the government kept changing and the priority of spending the money on it, which was another $3 million, I believe. Kind of became in and out of favor. And by the time they actually got started big time on it, they did some early work getting a little bit inland, but by the time they got inland substantially, trains were going through and roads were being built and all that. So it didn't get finished, believe it or not, until 1929, I think it was. It was or somewhere, 1923 maybe, somewhere in the early 20th century. So it was all like 90 years in the making, and by the time it was done, it was obvious it was only going to be a tourist thing. But that's fine, because Canada loves this thing. They love these canals. It draws lots of tourist dollars. Both canals, particularly the Trent-Severn, is loaded with towns and resorts and restaurants and campgrounds and you name it. You don't have to travel this thing by boat. You can do it by car and have a great time. This one is 240 miles and 44 locks and zigzags like crazy. Look at the chart. You'll wonder, but they tried to follow natural lakes and waterways as much as they could, take advantage of the existing, you know, waterways. But still, yep, they wound up with 45 locks for the same reason. The hardware is not quite the same as on the Rideau, but it's still mechanical except for a couple of modern locks they built along the way. And your fascination here is, by the way, just when the very first entrance to it, you're going to go underneath a bridge that says Trent-Severn. Keep to the right. I got a little confused there trying to read the buoys. I guess I should have done my homework in advance, and I wound up going up the wrong channel, and I could feel my propellers kind of just scraping on the on a rock ledge or something. It didn't do any damage. But yeah, I know. I backed off real quick and got on the right side. But it is confusing. Keep in mind, by the way, that all the buoys in that area on those canals are these crummy pencil type things. They're only 6 inches or so across. They're not all that visible. And I guess they've got budget crunches too, and there's been reports of some of them being out of place. And it's important to know that, because in a few areas, not too many, but in a few areas, you've got to zigzag what seems to be a straight path on a river. You got to zigzag it because there's a lot of rocks here and there. And you got to follow the path. And if you miss one of those buoys, like I did near Ottawa, you're going to find one of those rocks. And I've noted that, you know, Canadian rocks are very hard. So, yeah, you know, it just didn't lay us out, but, you know, it's one of those things. I always look upon hitting a prop or something on the Great Loop Trip as similar to the 53 Chevy you had when you were a kid. It's going to happen.
Yep. It seems to me, from my recollection from doing the Trent, and is that the lock masters are really good at telling you when there's markers missing between there and the next lock, or when there's some kind of a problem.
Yeah, I'd have to say that. And you know, let's go a little beyond that. The typical lock is staffed with a professional lock master, a full-time employee. He's probably even, I don't know what he does in the winter, but you know, he's a full-timer, and a bunch of college interns. And you just could not want to meet a better bunch of ambassadors for Canada. They're all good-looking. They're all friendly. They're all well-spoken. They're all, you know, just models. They really are. I mean, the women are gorgeous. The guys are good-looking. And the lock masters themselves are very professional. And they are truly ambassadors for Parks Canada. So, yeah, you're right. They do offer all kinds of stuff. And you know, I had one to offer me a box of donuts as I went by. All kinds of stuff, you know. And, you know, of course, you're spending the night right there at the lock, too, most of the time. So it's interesting. I've even seen some boaters get out and help them crank the locks, you know. So,
it's kind of
interesting. Yeah, probably the most notable town going across is Campbellford. And that's a good-sized town, and that's kind of neat. They've got a gigantic model of the Canadian loonie, which is the Canadian dollar coin. It's probably 20 feet high or something, you know, in a park there. And the reason they have it is because the sculptor who designed it lived or lives there. So this is kind of like, you know, a commemorative thing, right?
Yep.
And, you know, let's face it, you know, any country that can call their dollar a loonie and the $2 coin a toonie, they can't be all bad.
At least they got a sense of humor about it.
Oh, sure. And there is in Campbellford, by the way, what's called the world's greatest or most famous chocolate company or something. It's a great little factory, and you can load up on the seconds and all that. So, let's see, moving further west on the Trent Severn, you're going to go through some lakes and other lakes again. Some of them are spectacular. There's one spot, I don't remember where it is, where there's a little church perched on an island that has nothing. I mean, the church virtually takes up the whole island. And, of course, everybody has to go there by boat on Sunday. It's one of the most prettiest spots. The most notable things, of course, are the locks themselves, namely the Peterborough, the Kirkfield, rather, and Big Chute. And, you know, they're a wonder to behold. Peterborough is now 105 years old. It used to be the largest lip lock in the world. I don't believe it is anymore. But it raises 65 feet.
Bob?
Sorry?
Would you explain what the lift lock is? I'm not sure everybody knows.
Yeah, I was going to go now. Yeah. This is really interesting. There's a 5-foot difference between the height of the river at the top of the lock and the bottom of the lock. And basically, it consists of two bathtubs, for want of a better description, that I think are 60-something feet, 65 feet or so long, and they're interconnected underneath by hydraulic tubes that extend down into the riverbed for the full length of the drop. Now, what happens is it's sort of like a seesaw. When you're at the bottom, they have the back gate of that bathtub open, and you sail in and you tie up to the sidewall. And by the way, that's not as easy as it sounds. They don't have bollards. What they've got are these 1-inch steel rods horizontally down the length of the bathtub. And I found it really quite difficult. You don't have the strength to put a boat hook on that and pull your boat in, so you've got to maneuver your boat in there. And if there's a wind or something, you know, I had a little bit of difficulty staying there long enough to get a rope behind that pipe and back to the boat. But anyway, we did, so... But it's just something to be aware of. Be prepared when you get in there. Anyway, so you pull your boat into this bathtub. The other bathtub is up at the top of the lock on the other side, the top of the river, on the other side of the adjacent channel. So what happens is that bathtub stops 1 foot lower than the top, so that when they open the gate and fill that, they open the gate to let the water into that bathtub, it's heavier than the one on the bottom because it's up in the air and it's got more water. So they open the gate that connects the two hydraulic tubes. The excess weight of that makes that bathtub fall, and, of course, the hydraulic tubes that are interconnected push your lock up to the top, and then they open the gate and off you go. It's really fascinating. It was copied from European locks back in, you know, the early in 1900, whenever they were designing it. And it's been working perfectly. And it was, by the way, when it was built, it was the largest concrete, largest unreinforced concrete structure in the world. So why they didn't reinforce it, I don't know. But anyway, they poured it out of concrete, and the doggone thing is massive as well as beautiful. So it's put Peterborough on the map. There's not much there. I mean, plenty of restaurants and stuff. It's a nice town, but the lock, of course, is a star attraction. Kirkfield Lock is the same procedure, but it's only 45 feet. And then finally there's the big chute. But before you get there, let me mention a couple of other things. We found going through that even our four-foot draft may not have been quite enough. There was times on some of the lakes and stuff where we could feel ourselves dragging a little bit of silt. We didn't hit anything. It wasn't that severe, but even it may have been that year or something. So if you've got a five-foot boat, and as a matter of fact, it's almost required, you got to talk to both canals, and find out if there's any particular hazard you need to worry about with a five-foot draft boat. So the other thing is, when you get to some of these areas further on down the Trent Severn, try to stay tied up on Sundays. And the reason for that is a lot of these canals and lakes and rivers and so on up there have a lot of deadwood at the bottom of the area, either from old logging operations or just fallen trees or whatever. And they're right down at the bottom of the lake, which is only 5 feet or so deep to begin with. And you got these go-fast guys rolling across these lakes, stirring stuff up. And then next thing you know, you're passing over a deadhead and putting another dent in your props to match the one you got up in Ottawa for a while. So anyway, that's the caution. So the two cautions are, if you're more than 4 feet, talk to the canals before you attempt this. The other one is stay off the waterway on Sunday if you can avoid it. So I guess then that brings us to the big chute,
yep.
And this is fascinating. It's unbelievably fascinating. I think you drop about 100 feet or so, and they were going to replace it, but they never did. They only replaced the original big chute railway car with a bigger one. And the way this works is there's a rail that comes out of the water on the high side, goes over the hill, and then goes down the hill to the next level. And it's actually two sets of parallel tracks, but they're at different heights, so that as the car moves on its wheels, it stays level. So you don't have to worry about the thing tilting or all that. But the car itself is going to stay level. Now, it's actually a better way to describe this whole thing is a travel lift that runs on rails. Because that's exactly what it's like. You pull, you gather at the rather large docking area. And by the way, there's a camp associated with it. We can buy propane and food, camp food and all that kind of stuff. But anyway, on the morning, let's say that you're going to have passage, you tie up on the blue lines again, and the lock master will call you by megaphone, saying, you know, blue boat, come on in, you know, or whatever. It's because they're choosing how many boats they can get into this travel lift at the same time. It can accommodate two wide if there are smaller boats and two deep, you know, based on the length of the boat. I saw the thing the night before make a trip with a single jet ski in it. It was kind of funny. Anyway, there was no traffic, so the night before. Anyway, they call you and you literally drive into the thing the same way you would a travel lift. And it's submerged in the water on the rail. Then they start pulling up with a the type of system they use on overhead tramways, the same type of thing. It's cable drawn. They pull you up out of the water. The lock master looks at your running gear and says, "Hey, you know, did you hit a rock up in Ottawa?" Yeah. Anyway, so you get over the hill, and believe it or not, there's a roadway at the top of this hill. So, you know, the crossing guard gates come down just like on a train, right? And here comes your travel lift over the top of the hill and then starts running down. And as soon as you get down to the bottom end, you're floating. You just drive off. It's such a non-event, but it's so obviously intimidating when you think about it. But
yeah.
These guys do it every day, and that's that. And that's your next to the last lock before you get to the end of the Trent Severn. So,
Bob, we have somebody that called in with a question. Beth,
sure.
Can you talk to us about it?
Actually, it was Roger. I didn't recognize the number.
Okay, sorry. No question,
okay.
Just Roger.
Okay. All right, no question.
Just
okay.
Me.
Are there any websites that you're aware of that people can use to help them gather information?
Yeah, sure. Yeah, you know, there's obviously you get more and more information as you're going along here. One I found particularly helpful is Friends of the Redo, and their website is redofriends.com, redoufriends.com. And that's the Friends of the Redo, and I think that's a nonprofit chamber of commerce type thing that provides all kinds of stuff. There's plenty of books and charts available for sale on that site, but there's a lot of free stuff too. There's also a Canadian site. It's redoinfo.com, redeau-info.com. And then for the other one, there's trentsevern.com, which, again, is I think that one is run by the Parks Canada. And any of those sites will lead you to the availability of current books and all that. I did not find at the site, though, one that I found particularly helpful for the Trent Severn. But if you, this one is printed by Parks Canada. It's called Trent Severn Waterway Boating and Road Guide. So
okay.
If you do a search for Trent Severn Waterway Boating and Road Guide, it'll bring you to the Parks Canada site where you can buy it for $13 or so, although they said right now it's backordered. The last revision on that is 2009. That and this other book I've got, Rideau Boating and Road Guide, I'm not sure that one's in print anymore.
Okay.
They'll give you tons of information about the restaurants and hotels and all that. It really is an extraordinary experience. I'm not sure I understand why a lot of people do this. They just go up there and spend the whole summer, spend the whole vacation on those canals. It's so fascinating. You see loons, you know, there's plenty of ice cream shops, and there's all kinds of stuff. So, great place to spend a few weeks.
Great. Thanks for co-hosting, Bob. We really appreciate it.
Okay.
Just so everybody knows, we archive this, and it's going to be out on the website, and you can listen to it anytime you want. Janice, you want to talk about next week?
No, I don't.
Okay.
As of now, we don't have a show scheduled. I'm still trying. The summer, people are very, very busy and moving. I'm still trying to get someone to co-host next week, and I will announce it in the discussion forum as soon as I have someone.
Works for me.
Okay.
And
thanks for letting me on the show.
Thank you.
Thank you, Bob.
You bet.
Anybody, I do this every week, is anybody that's listening that's not a member of AGLCA, we'd sure love to have you. Join, and if you just go to www.greatloop.org, you can sign up for a membership. That's it. So, again, thanks, everybody. Have a good week, and we'll talk to you later.
Bye.
You bet. See ya.
Bye now.